Committee on Fisheries to order. Let the record reflect that it is 8:39 on Wednesday, April 13th. Let the record reflect that there is a quorum. Present are Representative Wilson, Co-Chairman Thomas, Representative Elkins, and myself, Representative Ledoux. And our agenda this morning includes House Bill 252 and House Bill 241. First item on the agenda is House Bill 252. Representative Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be in front of the committee this morning. This morning we have a proposal that's unlike many of the proposals. This particular proposal was hatched, sorry about the pun, in Fairbanks a couple of years ago, and it had to do with a group of us got together with Senator Stevens and looked to see what we could do about utilizing a fish hatchery program in the interior of Alaska in concert with the fish hatchery programs that we have in other places in the state. In some of the background data that I've given you folks, we used to have six hatcheries, if I recall, in the state, and now we're really down on to two main hatcheries in the state that were functioning in the interior and in actually functions out of South Central and Southeast here. So what we're trying to do here in this particular bill is trying to establish a couple of funds that would allow us to build a fish hatchery in Fairbanks and another fish hatchery to rebuild the fish hatchery in Port Richardson. The utilization of warm water is problematic, and what has happened, the problem that's happened here was that we had a situation where we're going to run out of hot water in the Fort Richardson hatchery by October of 2005. As I understand it, it's going to be no longer available. So there's been some urgency to try and figure out some way to either fund a new hatchery or figure out some way to do it with a mechanism that will allow us to have these hatcheries available so that we can increase the number of sport fish that will be able to be utilized by the people that come to Alaska. And it's, of course, that's a great draw for most of the tourists to come up here, or many of the tourists to come up here and wet a line and see if they can catch a fish or two. Madam Chair, what I'd like to do is just go through a couple. I don't need to take the bill over down the all the different roads that we could go down. What I'd like to do is, with your indulgence, is to have you look at what we're doing here. In your packet, you should have this schematic here, which shows you how the funds would be utilized by the revenue bonds. And in the bill on page 3, section 4, line 18 through 26, it shows through 27, 28, it shows what the surcharge would be on different sport fishing enthusiasts and folks that would pay this extra charge to build these hatcheries. A particularly great selling point on this mechanism is, as you will see, the numbers of increases that the increase to the fishing licenses, sport fishing licenses, will be by the by our determination. It looks like it'll raise about $6.1 million, and $1.1 million of that will be from resident sport fishing licenses, but the other $5 million will be from non-residents, which is about 80%, which means to service these bonds, we'll be able to service them, 80% of it will be paid for by the non-residents as they are utilizing, which I think is a real good selling point. And then just to give you a breakdown, the breakdown of how it's going to be utilized, how the money, it's $69 million is the total bonding portion, as you'll see in the sponsor statement. And it'll be broken down, and I hope, do they have this piece, how it's broken down? Okay. Maybe we could get that for them, if you would, Jim. Crystal Lake, which is by Wrangell, would receive $193,000 over 10 years and $500,000 deferred, or roughly $2.5 million. Skagway would receive $1.6 million over 10 years, $160,000 per year. And the NSRAA, which is Sitka Haines, will receive $1.4 million over 10 years. And then there's $5.5 million, and that's $5.5 million. Then out of the other in the $69 million, there's $3.5 million in reserves. There's $45 million for the Anchorage Fort Richardson hatchery and $15 million for the Fairbanks. We already have $10 million in federal receipts that are available, thanks to Ted Stevens. And the projects look like they're in good position to be built. And with your concurrence, Madam Chair, I have also Mr. Gordon Garcia, who is the guru of building fish hatcheries with the state of Alaska, with us here, that would be welcome. Who would give you any kind of information you need to know about a fish hatchery. He knows a lot more than I do about it. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be willing to take any questions you'd like.
Thank you. Representative Hampton?
It sounds like, Representative Holm, you've taken care of everybody pretty well.
We've tried to.
Yeah, it sounds like
Mr. Hampton.
And I compliment you on that. It makes it easier for South Leachers to support this.
Well, I appreciate that. Through the chair, Representative Elkins, that one of the problems we always have, as you well know, is to try and build consensus here in this and it's kind of hard to. It's like herding cats, as you well know. And so what we're trying to do here is we're trying to make sure that some of the areas that have not, and Sitka in particular, has not had some help for some time. And so we were trying to put some trying to help everybody a little bit.
Representative Wilson?
I'm just trying to find, it's not in the bill itself, where
the application of the funds?
Yeah.
I can't respond to that, is it in the operating proposal?
Well, I just... is this just something that the department is just...
Yeah, hold on a second. Just a minute.
Is just going to do automatically, or is this something that, I want to make sure that it's locked in so that mines won't get changed along the way.
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, there's a companion...
This
is Doug Vincent-Lang with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Assistant Director.
There's
a companion CIP proposal. There's three parts of this bill. There's the piece that deals with the surcharge, which is the revenue generation. There's the piece that builds up the revenue structure to issue the bonds, and that's in the bill before you. There's also a CIP request. That CIP request contains the authority to give the department the authority to expend money to spend on the bond, which has three pieces in it. It has the capital budget pieces into it. So the Fort Richardson hatchery is part of the bond, the Elmendorf hatchery is part of the bond, and the things that we could do with capital improvements are part of the bond in Southeast Alaska. There's that debt service payment will be about 5.2 to 5.3 million per year. The operational costs will come from the revenue difference between 6 million and 5.3 million. And the authority to expend the projects we're talking about operational in Southeast Alaska are included in that CIP as part of operational costs for the next 10 years.
Okay, so is that going to have to be put in the budget every year, or is it going to be automatic?
My understanding is that when we put the CIP request in, that authority's there. What we're going to need every year is authority to expend the debt service. We need to get authority from the legislature to pay back the bond debt repayment. But once we have that CIP request that's gone through, we'll have the authority for those projects for the life of their projects.
So next year, when you put in that request, the next legislature could say, well, we want to use that money for something else. Could they
My understanding is that they couldn't, because the CIP request will have gone through.
They could not, or
they could not. Those projects are set within the CIP request for the life of their projects.
I see some heads shaking back there, so could I?
Sorry. For the record, this is Sarah Gilbertson. I'm Special Assistant to the Commissioner of Fish and Game. And my understanding is that and I just got off the phone with our Admin Services Director, Tom Lawson, that the $62 million that's part of the bond is in the CIP request, the capital budget for this year. That does not need to be approved annually. However, the $3.5 million in operating save for Crystal Lake will need to be approved annually by the legislature. However, we do have a letter from Makai Campbell, our new commissioner, that outlines our intentions to fight for that money every year. That's our intentions, where we intend to spend the money in Southeast. So we're going to stick to that.
Eric. In your packet, you have a letter from, it's this letter here from the governor's office, from Fish and Game.
What's the date?
The date is April 12th, and it's a two-page letter from Makai Campbell, commissioner pending his approval. And it spells out how these funds will be. There's 938,800 per year. And then on the second page, it shows how the different hatcheries get 193,000 for Crystal Lake, for example.
Follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I don't feel good about that, because it looks to me that it's locked in for sure that the money's going to go to pay the new hatcheries and make sure that they get paid for it, but it doesn't look to me like it's locked in. Is there anything we can do to lock this in for the next 20 years so that we know that the next legislature coming along, there isn't somebody in here that wants to yank that money for something else?
You have to give your name again every time you do this.
This is Doug Minson-Lang. Through the chair, I believe that when this is within the CIP budget request, that you have told us by approving that CIP budget request that those are the projects that you would like to have done for the life of their projects. Now, you might need to annually appropriate the money to those projects, but I don't think you could. You would have to end the projects by not approving those expenditures. You see what I'm saying? It's kind of a circular argument. You have to annually appropriate the money to that project, but you'd have to end it by not appropriating it to, because you put that project within a CIP request for the life of that project. Now, you would have to, just like the debt service payment, you as a legislature has to expend the funds to make that debt service payment. In this case, you would also have to annually appropriate the funds for those projects, because we can't dedicate those things for the next 10 years. That's the legislature's prerogative to dedicate funds, but we're committed to that. That's why we put it in there, for the life of those projects, to give those kinds of the life to those projects.
Okay, so it's different than the regular money that was in the budget this year that someone was able to take out and totally use it for something totally different. That's what I'm concerned about.
That's my understanding. That's why it's within a CIP request.
Yeah, Representative Elkins, and then I've got a question.
Yeah, I got a little bit confused. I think if it's bond money and the bonds are sold to do specific things, then the money raised from those bonds theoretically can only be used for those things. So if we want to protect Peggy for what she's talking about, we would want to be sure that when we sell those bonds, that those projects are designated in the bonds. That's my understanding.
This is Doug again, through the chair. We've been told by revenue, and we can get revenue up here, that we can't include operational costs within a bond package. But we can include it within the CIP request.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't think we're talking about, I think we're talking about, primarily we're talking about construction money and renovation money. So we're talking about bricks and mortar here.
No,
I don't think we're necessarily talking about operation.
No, there is, there's operation too. So my question is then, can we amend?
Have you finished, Representative Elson?
Yes, I am.
So let me just ask a question, Representative Wilson, and then I'll come to you. As everybody's patting themselves on the back, trying to make, because everybody's been made happy here, I just want to point out that there doesn't seem to be anything in these hatcheries for my neck of the woods. Is there any thought, perhaps, of adding something for the Kodiak area?
Madam Chair, no. At this point, no. The whole project, I think, is, and I think Fish and Game could probably speak to that.
Madam Chair, certainly our ability to produce fish in Kodiak is highly dependent upon the ability for the Fairbanks hatchery, I mean the Anchorage hatcheries, to produce fish over the next 10 to 15 years. We, with the loss of hot water, we're not able to meet current production needs, and Kodiak currently gets stocked with about a third of a million fish, a variety of different species. We're going to decrease stocking probably in the Kodiak area because we can't simply meet the production with the current hatchery facilities we have. If we build a new hatchery in Anchorage, we're going to build that hatchery to meet demand, projected demand for the next 20 years. That some of that demand is going to be down in Kodiak. So we're going to produce more fish down in the Kodiak area based on the stocking plan, the five-year stocking plan, which drives us in Kodiak. So yes, Kodiak will be serviced, and we will be able to meet demand in Kodiak with this new bond package.
What's stocked in Kodiak?
I think we gave you that list. It's a variety of different species, from coho salmon to rainbow trout to chinook salmon.
King.
Coho salmon
and anadromous king and coho salmon and rainbow trout into many of the landlocked lakes. So it's a wide variety of species, and of course that is the stocking strategy is based on a stocking plan which is locally driven. What we do is we send that stocking plan out every 5 years for review, and there's public input into that stocking plan, and that drives where we're going to stock fish over the next 5 to 10 years. And the Kodiak people have input into that process.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. The fact that we can't put that wording in the bond package itself, can we put this in statute so that there's no question? Because it has happened that money has been taken out of one place to use it for something else. And so I think if we want to make sure that this all happens the way this says, then we need to get something in statute or something so it says that. And if for the next 20 years, I mean, not forever, but for the length of the time that we're talking here, so that we make sure that what we say here will happen.
Madam Chair, Representative Wilson, I think we want to keep this bond package as clean as possible from revenue's perspective. Now, I agree with what you're saying, and I think that's why you want to keep that language direction in the CIP budget request, which is for the life of the project. That's why we do CIP budget requests. They're for the term of the projects. We definitely can't commit to do a complete capital improvement project within 1 year. So we want to make sure that we have the language tightened into that CIP budget request that assures that the life of that project will continue for as long as it's necessary. In this case, for Southeast Alaska, the term that we've committed to do those projects based on the Commissioner's letter to Representative Thomas.
The reason that we have the same thing with DOT. Mm-hmm. We do CIP things with DOT, and it gets changed around all the time. So,
Representative Holmes?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Wilson through the chair. I agree with your frustration. It is the most frustrating thing in the world to see that our DOT projects are not funded in the northern region. I mean, I fought that as transportation chair for a couple of years. It's true with all the things that we do there here. We don't dedicate funds. We can't. We're appliers of funds. We're not allocators of funds. And because of that, we're frustrated. And I appreciate your frustration. But this particular bill is about building two fish hatcheries. And we've incorporated, in addition to that, some help for Southeast and some help for these other areas. And so it hasn't been the major focus. It's been an add-on. And we've tried to accommodate those areas. you certainly could have some intent language in here, but the intent is already here from Fish and Game to do this. And as in all of our budgetary processes, as you well know, Representative Wilson, we cannot go to another legislature and bind them. And of course, we can't bind because we won't be here. We can't bind another Fish and Game Department if it takes another course. And unfortunately, that's just the way those things happen. So I feel for your frustration. I also am frustrated out of a number of other issues as well. But I know that we don't allocate these funds, and they've given us their assurances. And as long as this administration's in play, I know those insurances will be there. But I think that's probably the best we can do, Madam Chair.
It might be helpful if I called Tom Bowden up.
Thanks. Tom Boutin, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. I think I can answer some of the questions, but probably not all the concerns through the chair. What Representative Elkins said is exactly right. There's a much stronger commitment for a capital project that's in bond documents, for which bonds have been sold to bondholders, so far as the ability of any administration, any department to change the projects, than if bonds hadn't been issued. And so the projects for which the bonds are issued, the hatcheries and deferred maintenance included, those capital projects will be part of the bond documents, and people purchasing those bonds, we can't look into their minds and decide whether the projects were very important to them or whether they just wanted that interest rate return at the time that the bonds happened to be sold. Typically, people in a community that's going to receive the benefit of those projects will tend to buy the bonds at retail. We can only surmise partly because they're interested in those projects. And so the State Bond Committee could not allow then, if they were alerted, the projects to change once the bonds had been issued. The bond indenture is actually the contract between the State Bond Committee and the bondholders. And so for the capital projects, which is the deferred maintenance and the hatchery construction in the different parts of the state, it would be problematic if after the bonds were sold, there was an attempt to divert the money to some project not in the bond documents.
Thank you. And by the way, Representative Salmon joined us probably about 10 minutes ago, and I neglected to note that. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, this is Douglasson Lang again. I also, Representative Wilson, want to tell you that the legislature has to annually appropriate the debt service payment, too. So to the same extent that you're worried about future legislatures not funding projects in Southeast Alaska, they could make us default in our bond, theoretically, by not paying for the debt service payment back onto these bonds. So, you know, you have a commitment from us that we're going to do this as a package. We feel strongly that there needs to be recreational fishing opportunities expanded in Southeast Alaska. Southeast Alaska is going to pay for part of these proceeds that are going to be used to pay back these things. So we're committed to doing it. But we can't bind future legislators, just like we can on anything, to how they're going to spend money.
You can't retire, Peggy.
Representative Thomas.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a question about, as Alaska grows and sport fish licenses that are being sold increase through the next several years, does that mean you can retire the debt quicker? All license fees that you generate above this sales for this next year go to retire the debt, the $850?
Through the Chair, Representative Thomas. The amount of money that will go through increased license sales will be into the pot of money into the Fish and Game Fund that can go be allocated by the legislature to do any variety of projects regarding sport fish management or research in the state. The percent on the surcharge will be available for debt reduction or any kind of other project. But I think it would be our intention to pay down that debt as quickly as possible.
I'm trying to just get a grasp on this entire bill. These are for hatcheries which are going to be built in Fairbanks, correct? And in?
Anchorage.
Anchorage.
Two.
And one Skagway, small one.
One Skagway.
And then, what are the additional projects in Southeast?
Do you want to answer that, Representative Holt?
Yeah, it's on the list I've got here. Hold on a second here. I hit it. Did I hit it? Crystal Lake? There they are. I've got them. Let me, since my staff filled this out, let him talk about it. Since how he wants to.
He wants to say Sven Dine. For the record, Jim Derringer, staff to Representative Holm. In meeting with Fish and Game, the way they had explained it to us is currently Crystal Lake is getting $193,000 in federal money per year to support activity down there in sport fishing. That money is going to be going away, my understanding is next year or the year after, and they're committed to using proceeds of this to replace that federal money with $193,000 over a 10-year period of time to continue with that type of sport fish enhancement down there. In addition, they plan to put $500,000 of one-shot money one time the first year into deferred maintenance of the plant itself, of the hatchery itself at Crystal Lake. My understanding is that's operated by, and I know the acronym, SSRAA?
SRAA.
Right. Up in the northern region, there's a similar organization. It's, the acronym is NSRAA, I think it's NSRAA. And those folks have not been receiving any money in the past from Fish and Game to support their activities up there. The plan is to give them $140,000 for the same 10-year period of time to support sport fish out in that area and to do a one-shot $150,000 deferred maintenance on that facility. So those are the two of the projects. The third one is Skagway, and Skagway has indicated an interest in having a hatchery as well. A small hatchery, something that is a production facility that will have the ability for visitors to look in, but not really a tourist trap, so to say, just more of a production facility. They have the option of either getting a $1.5 million one-shot to build a hatchery in Skagway. They're committed to all the operational expenses thereafter. The state would not be required to put any money in. Or they would be given the option, if they do not feel that the operating expenses is something they can afford, Fish and Game is committed to give them $160,000 a year for 10 years. So they have their option of either $1.6 million over 10 years or one-shot $1.5 million to build the hatchery, and then they're on their own. So those are the enhancements in Southeast that $5.5 million would be dedicated towards taking care of in this package.
Well, I'll tell you what my concern is here. We're looking at what strikes me as a pretty huge jump in what people are going to be paying for their fishing licenses, from like $10 to $18.50 or something like that, once you add in this increment. And it's going to be pretty hard for me to explain to folks in my district that they're paying this huge jump for their increase in sports fishing licenses when Fairbanks is being taken care of, Anchorage is being taken care of, Southeast is being taken care of, and it looks like just about every place in the state is being taken care of other than Kodiak and I guess up in the interior.
Madam Chair, if I could respond and then I'll give it to Doug. At the beginning of this, I told you we're losing the water for Richardson. If you lose a rider for that, you're losing all of the fish you're going to get in Kodiak, period. So you're going to lose them. Another major component of this, if you remember, is that 80% of this will be paid for by non-residents, not by resident fishermen, but by non-residents. So to sell it to your people, trust me, you're going to get an additional number of fish brought into Kodiak on the Richardson, from the Richardson, Fort Richardson hatchery, and you're not going to lose those stocks, and it's not going to be paid for by the folks in Kodiak. It's going to be paid for by the, and by the way, it's from $15 to $23.50, just so you know.
Thank you.
Yes.
I might answer that question slightly different, too. This is Doug Vincent-Lang again. The hatcheries do three things. They provide additional fishing opportunity. Across the state of Alaska, they provide anywhere from 10 to 20% of the recreational fishing opportunity. They in so doing, providing that recreational fishing opportunity, they take pressure off fully allocated wild stocks. So we have to do something with our hatchery program. If we don't do something with our hatchery program, you're going to see a lot more pressure on wild stocks. Given that our hatcheries are in decline, we're going to have to somehow deal with our hatchery infrastructure, whether it's through this bond or some other thing. And it'll likely, the wild stock management program will likely have to take some kind of suffering in the short term to deal with our hatchery infrastructure issues. And we've been trying to deal with that over the last 3 to 4 years, and it's no longer manageable. And the other thing is it provides significant economic benefit. A recent study showed that hatchery production results in about $45 million annually to the Alaskan economy. So this will, over the life of this bond, give about $800 million to the Alaskan economy for a $60 million bond. Now, in your district specifically, we stock about over a third of a million fish. Those provide recreational fishing opportunities, especially for families that want to get out and start to learn how to fish. It's an excellent opportunity for kids to go out with parents and fish in these lakes where otherwise they wouldn't have those opportunities. And those opportunities are mainly, at least in the Stock Lake areas, are mainly benefiting Alaskan residents. So, yeah, it's a jump, but we haven't seen a jump in license fee increases for the last 15 years. It's time. And it's time for people to start paying for the hatcheries that they benefit and for the local economy. And we guarantee you that you're going to be able to meet your stocking needs in Kodiak into the future as outlined by that stocking plan. We're not going to be able to do that if we don't get this bond package.
What lakes are you talking about around Kodiak? And by the way, could you identify yourself for the record when you speak?
Abercrombie, Oral, Big, Bull, Caroline, Chicknick, Airport, Sicily.
Did you just say Chignik?
Chignik Airport, yes. Lake?
That's not in Kodiak.
The Kodiak Road System, landlocked lake in area. I'm just going through the whole area, the Kodiak management area for you. Dragonfly, Heitzman, Horseshoe Lake, Jack, Juniper, Lee, Lily, Long, Lupine, Margaret, Satron, Southern, Tanikinik, and Twin Lakes. All receive fish from our enhancement program at Fort Richardson and Elmendorf. And they receive a combination of either coho or rainbow trout. And the stocking schedule are either annual or semi-annual, depending upon the production capabilities of those lakes. And I can get a copy of this table for you if you'd like.
Thank you. Representative Salmon, did you have a question?
I did have a question. First of all, if you look at the map up there, you know, it starts off from Fairbanks, goes down to Anchorage, and a little further down into the southwest, and it goes over to the southeastern. But why isn't, you know, the state money used for more of the state of Alaska? I mean, sports fishing, I mean, license increase. They say the outside people is going to pay for it. But, you know, a lot of people depend on that increase in the airline business, because the people that goes hunting up in those areas do use these people that pays for it. And I don't think, you know, if they're not going to be using that stock, I mean, why should they pay for that increase?
There's only a sport fishing increase. There's no hunting increase.
Well, a lot of people we take out there are sports people.
But their sport fishers are from out of state, usually. If you're hauling, flying people out, usually they're from out of state that I know of. Or I've flown out of state. Of course, I've fished a number of places I haven't lived in the state. But the cost of transportation, the cost of going to those places to get those wonderful fishing experiences was minimized by the amount of money that I paid for my license. It didn't have anything to do with how much it cost me to go fishing or go flying. So I don't know that that's a large thing. A person who's eligible for a $5 resident hunting and fishing and trapping license under this section, under Section 4, is exempt from the surcharge. A number of folks are exempt from the surcharge of local folks. So under Section 4, page 3, line 7 and 8, shows the exemptions. So if you were concerned about exemptions for folks that could either couldn't pay for it or might be adversely impacted, and that may answer your question.
Madam Chair, Representative Salmon. The other thing that's occurring is that...
Please identify
yourself. This is Doug Vincent-Lang with Fish and Game. I'm sorry. A lot of things that happen in rural Alaska is we take significant pressure off of wild stocks by our hatchery program in the urban areas. Those people could potentially fly to those areas and put increasing pressure on those areas. So there is a direct benefit to the rural areas of Alaska by keeping pressure off the wild stocks. The other thing is that we do a lot of stock assessment in rural areas. To the extent that we have to keep band-aiding our hatchery program, those things are going to be in competition with our ability to band-aid our hatchery program. And over time, we're probably going to have to erode into some of that wild stock assessments. And we want to continue that. We are committed to continuing our wild stock assessment in the rural areas because we know how important it is. So this does benefit rural area anglers across the state.
Representative Thomas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I like this bill, and the chairman asked me if I was involved. I said, yes, Skagway is asked to put a hatchery in there. Right now, hatchery is a recipient under state funds working through DIPAC. They would like to manage and operate their own facility in Skagway and not be in the general fund money each year. We're asking for operation funds. So it'll be a one-time appropriation for them, which we're paying, I believe, in excess of 100-some thousand now for them to stock fish there. And to get to what Representative Salmon was saying about the rural reason, I've been following this since day one, since the inception, and I liked it from right off the bat. I represent Cordova, and they have, a lot of fish go up to the interior, and I know that the impact of dip netting is going to increase while we take time to build this hatchery in Fairbanks. So what it's going to do, Representative Sam, is put more pressure on the rural area fisheries as there's no opportunity for people in the Fairbanks area. And the other reason I like to, in the Anchorage facility, is being a fisherman, a lot of that fish is going to go by Kodiak anyway to go to the interior. We call it common property fishery. It would be intercepted by sport fishermen, commercial fishermen. Everybody's going to have an opportunity at these fish. And so, like I said, I went through all the briefings when long before the bills were put in, and I think I thought, and I still feel the same way, that it'll take the pressure off the rural areas, where we like our own little fishing spots, and concentrate them in more at home. And I like the opportunity of, I saw a report where they took 110,000 reds from dip netting last year. Well, maybe those people, if they only get a week off to go fishing, will go to a lake that they're stocking in or around Fairbanks rather than driving down. I guess it's a Chitna or something, if they go dip netting, that they will stay home. So anyway, and of course, Southeast, I don't fish down by South Sarah, but Ensor at the same time came in and said that they're not involved in producing fish. I mean, getting paid for producing any fish, so we put a program in there for them. So I think it is well-rounded, and the way I was looking at it anyway, again, being briefed all the way through and then being familiar with some of the fisheries here. So the main thing that I liked was taking the pressure off the rural areas and people flying in there and impacting them negatively.
Representative Elkins?
Madam Chair, just to supplement what Bill said, I find it interesting that in 04, from Cordova South, there were 131,000 licenses, almost 132,000 licenses, and generated $3 million in total revenue. That's roughly 28% of all the licenses sold in the state. So, the area has a major impact on the money coming into the fisheries.
Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just wanted to mention, in the interior, we used to live in Tok. We lived there for 4 years. And we used to go up between Tok and Fairbanks. There's several lakes all along there that get stocked because we've been up there fishing. And I think Little Donna Lake and Big Donna Lake, and I don't know some of the other ones.
Quartz Lake.
Yeah, that really make it really fun to fish, because if somebody had come from out of state, we would take them up there and go back in and go to those lakes, and you can really catch fish there, and you know, it's pretty impressive, because you can get really nice trout in those lakes. So it you know, I do know that I've been up there, and it's there, and the fish are waiting for us to catch them.
Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? I think we've got somebody, Kelly Hepler from ADFG, who is online to answer any questions, and then we've got Russell Thomas from Ketchikan. Russell, do you want to state your name again and your affiliation?
Yeah, my name is Russell Thomas. I work for Alaska Sport Fishing Expeditions. It's a family-owned business. We operate three resorts in the Ketchikan area, and we've been in business here for about 20 years. I do have some concerns about House Bill 252 in its current form, especially after reading some of the documents that were just sent down this morning and then listening to some of the testimony. I think the biggest concern that I have, and I've heard it stated over and over again, that you know, we shouldn't worry about this because non-residents are going to pay for it, and it shouldn't really make any difference because they're going to cover 80% of the cost. And then, as I read through some of the information that was provided, I'll try and find where I'm getting this from. The sport fishery enhancement proposal by the ADF&G and the Department of Revenue. Stated there was a few things in there. They on the first page, it said we propose a modest surcharge on both non-resident and resident sport fishing licenses. Some of the surcharge is up close to double what the license cost. If you buy a one-day non-resident fishing license for $10, the surcharge is $8.50, which is 85% of the original cost. I don't know. I guess in dollars, maybe $8.50 is maybe what someone would consider modest. But as a percentage of what the cost used to be compared to what it is now, I don't think anybody could agree that that is a modest increase. As you get, obviously, longer licenses, the fee gets larger and can be close to $50, which may or may not be modest to some people. As you turn the page towards the back, it says, it's a question and answers part of the document. It says, what impact will the surcharge have on charter operators and sport fishing guides? And it's stated, there is no correlation between changes in license tag fees and the number of licenses tags sold, or in the number of angler days of fishing effort with guides. I think it would be a big mistake to think that there is absolutely no correlation between how much a fishing license costs and whether or not people choose to do fishing as a recreational activity, especially given the fact that some people are here on a cruise ship for just a few hours. Here in Ketchikan, the half-day cruise ship charters are a big part of the fishing. And somebody already in the king salmon season will pay $10 for a one-day license, $10 for a king salmon tag, and now an additional $8.50 in a surcharge. That means that 4 hours of fishing, in addition to what they've already paid to go out on the boat, will cost them close to $30. If there truly is no correlation between the changes in fishing license tags and fees and the number of licenses sold, then we could justify, you know, raising the amount to double what it currently is proposed as, with justification being that we'd really like $12 million instead of six, and there would be no negative effect whatsoever, and I think all of us could agree that that's just not true. I guess the biggest problem that I have with the bill is that there's a large amount of revenue generated in parts of the state that won't necessarily benefit in a big degree to, you know, the money that's raised. And these non-residents, the 80% who are paying for this project, are customers that I have invested my money to get. who will now be, in essence, funding some of my competition. If we enhance fisheries in the northern area, in Anchorage and Fairbanks, to the point that that fishing then becomes better than what we have to offer here in Southeast Alaska, then my customers choose to go there to fish rather than stay in Southeast and spend money here. So in essence, what you're asking me to do as a business owner is to encourage my customers to fund my competition farther north. In its current form, I would like to see this body consider that resources that are raised in certain areas, the fish and game has certain, you know, management areas all over the state, that the money raised in those management areas stays in that management area, that if we have this allocation, that this surcharge, the $850 that's raised in Southeast Alaska on every license and stamp that's sold here, stays in Southeast Alaska for projects that enhance Southeast Alaska. For Anchorage, those, you know, the Kenai, those areas that are selling fishing licenses and are under different management plans, I would like to see that money stay in those areas and benefit those businesses and those anglers that frequent those areas. I think that's a fair and equitable way to do that. People buy fishing licenses all over the state. And this would be one way to ensure that my customers, that I'm not funding my competition by bringing customers here and having that money go farther north. And likewise for them, as they invest in money in getting customers to come to Anchorage, Fairbanks, the Kenai, the interior, that those people aren't coming here to fish because of enhancement efforts that are take place here and not up there. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to address this committee this morning.
Thanks very much, Mr. Thomas. Representative Thomas?
Thank you. Russell, if what you said was true statewide, and you would get no oil revenues because all the oil revenues generated in the northern part of Alaska, if, you know, if people wanted to be like that. I just want to ask, when was the last time, you know, I believe somebody said it was 16 years since sport license been increased. Is that proper, or 15? Have you increased your sport charter fees in the last 15 years, or you've been stagnant like the sport license?
No, I haven't, and I don't think it's fair to say, to characterize that I am opposed to an increase in fishing licenses. But what I would never do, what I would never be able to do, would be to hold my rates steady for 15 years or 10 years and then double them in 1 year. There's no way I could justify to my customers, well, the rates have been the same for 10 years, and so now you have to pay double. If you ever go to McDonald's or any fast food chain, they never raise the price significantly. They raise it 2 or 3 pennies at a time, and over some period of time, now I'm paying a quarter or 50 cents more for a fountain drink than I was before. I don't understand why it seems like every time we address problems like this, all of a sudden we don't do anything, and then we slap a big increase in price. If this was a dollar every other year for the last 5 years and now we're at $8.50, nobody would be complaining. It's the fact that people have been paying the same amount for a long time, and now in some cases you're going to close to double the cost of the fishing license.
Representative Salmon, did you have a question? And then Representative Elkins?
I didn't have a question. I was just expressing my concern. That's the true case of the matter.
Representative Elkins, did you have a question for Mr. Thomas? Sure.
I don't know if anybody in Fish and Game or anybody down there have the answer, but do you have any idea what it costs to fish in British Columbia? Or what it costs to fish in the state of Washington or Oregon as an out-of-stater?
I don't know. I think, you know, if I'm being truthful, there are some people, especially on a 3 or a week-long tag, when I tell them that it's $30, they think that sounds a little bit low, and I don't disagree with that. But the concern I have is twofold. One is, I don't want to be funding my competition farther north. And the other side of that is it seems like a fairly dramatic increase at one time. If this was prorated out over 5 years or something, I think that wouldn't be as big of a deal.
Well, I was, excuse me, Madam Chair, but in just a short rebuttal, I was in the most competitive business in the city of Ketchikan for 30 years, and I firmly believe in competition, and the better the more competition, the keener you are. So I can't buy into that, but I'm sure it. You're right about one thing. We're cheap compared to British Columbia and Oregon and Washington and Hawaii.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hepler is on the line, I believe, too, and he should have that information.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Kelly Hepler, Director of Division of Sportfish, and thanks to the committee for taking the time this morning. Also, Representative Holmes for passing this bill on the House side. Madam Chair, I think Doug Bensalang probably has a list. We went back and reviewed the out-of-state charges, non-resident charges in other states, and you'll find that we're probably in the bottom third in Alaska, or maybe the bottom, between bottom third and bottom half. But if you go back and look at the opportunities that a non-resident can exercise in Alaska, is incredible. The number of fish they can bring back, and you know, the wealth and the opportunities they have here is different. You see, like in the state of Washington, so... Representative Elk and some other people, I think you're correct. And if you want the exact numbers, Madam Chair, I think we can probably get that into the committee record. Thank you.
What about, Kelly, the price of residence licenses? How do we compare in Alaska to that of Washington, Oregon, other states? Do you have that offhand?
Madam Chair, you know, I was looking for that information this morning. All my information is sitting down in Juneau, so I apologize for that, but I know... Doug and those guys have in their packet, but we're even better bargaining at that point. I think we're in the lower 25%, or maybe 20-25%. So for residents, it's a heck of a bargain right now.
Thank you, Representative Elkins.
I can guarantee you the seniors get a heck of a deal.
We seniors.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other public testimony? Well, then I will close public testimony. And, closing public testimony, but not adjourning the meeting. And turn this over to the committee for discussion. Representative Elkins.
For discussion, I would move HB 252 version A with individual recommendations and accompanying physicals.
Any objections? Yes, okay. Then we need to call the roll.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Thomas?
Yes.
Representative Ledoux?
Chairman.
Oh, okay.
My mind is drawing a blank. I'm sorry. Representative Elkins.
Yes.
Representative Salmon.
No.
I didn't say anything.
You didn't say anything.
No. Okay.
I'm doing your job. I've forgotten your name. My mind is drawing a blank. Sorry. Ledoux, sorry.
No.
3A, 2 no.
So I think that means it doesn't pass.
There's four.
3-2, it passes.
Members present?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
Members present.
You just have to have four present to deal with the business, but it's the majority of the members present.
I thought we dealt with that the other day in CRA.
And they said...
And that you got an opinion, and it was 3-2, did not pass.
It did.
I know.
It did the other day.
Representative...
Chairman, we had that same problem last week, and that was true. It takes four to come out of the committee.
Well, let's get a ruling on it.
Call Legislative Affairs. We can call Speaker Harris.
Taking that easy. Let's see it.
Well, we can either take an ADs or go to the next...
next bill?
Why don't we go to the next bill?
You're the chair.
So let's go to HB 241, Board of Fisheries, Conflict of Interest.
You want me to stay here or go?
Your choice.
I'll just stay here.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Representative Peggy Wilson, and this bill, House Bill 241, is Board of Fisheries Conflict of Interest. This implements changes recommended by the Joint Salmon Task Industry Task Force to the Board of Fisheries Conflict of Interest policy. The Board of Fisheries is not as effective as it should be when members with the most knowledge and experience in certain areas must excuse themselves when those issues arise. The Board of Fisheries is the lay board, and it consists of members of various backgrounds. Some are involved in commercial fishery, some are recreational fishermen, some are fishing lodge owners, and others are just public members with an interest in fishing. Under current policy, the Department of Law is very conservative in their recommendation of who should participate. And when there's even a perception of a conflict, they get really nervous about this and recommend that their members excuse themselves, and therefore avoiding any possible litigation at all. And because of this, members are not allowed to use their expertise and knowledge when it's just even
a majority of members present.
Keep going.
Let's have an
Aries.
You're
going to run out of.
You know, commercial fishermen get certain slots, so that they're appointed to that board because they're knowledgeable in those areas. And what's happened now, the policy of the board is that if there's even a perception that there might be a conflict of interest, they say that they have to say there's a conflict of interest. And not only do they can't vote, but they can't even discuss it when they have the most knowledge. They're the most knowledgeable people on there that would be able to explain to the other ones what's going on, and they can't even talk. So what this bill does is allows that the members would have a that the members present would do the same thing that legislators do. They would just say, well, there's a conflict of interest, and then they would go on. You explain and share their knowledge with it with others and vote just like we legislators do on the floor or in committee. Very same thing. And I think that's important because the people with the knowledge should be able to share that knowledge with the rest of the committee. So this bill now requires the Board of Fisheries members to disclose a personal or financial interest on the record before participating in matters before the board. If they disclose a conflict of interest, this would not disqualify a board member from participating in and voting on the matters before the board. And the Department of Law has proposed an amendment. Are they here? Oh, they're online. Okay. And I will let them explain their amendment.
Thank you. And by the way, we're back in.
Okay. You know what I do? I'd like to ask for a reconsideration of that last vote. And
right.
So, anyway. So
let's move forward. We want to get this. There's enough support on this one. I think.
So is there any questions for Representative Wilson? Okay, it looks like we've got a number of people online to testify.
Can we adopt or have somebody address the amendments so we can
amend? Let's talk. Let's let the...
legal or...
Okay, they're online. The Department of Law, Steve Daugherty is online.
Okay, Ms. Daugherty?
Through the chair, this is Stephen Daugherty. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law in Anchorage. I'm calling regarding the technical issues with the bill. We have proposed an amendment that would address those technical issues, and we would not have any legal concerns with the bill once those amendments were adopted. We believe that the intent of the bill is to allow a board member to participate in a matter before the board after disclosure, despite having a personal or financial interest in a matter before the board, not as a broad exemption from the Ethics Act. And in order to accomplish this and make sure that the board members can, in fact, participate, we need to add some additional language to the bill. There are two problems with the original language. First, there is an express exemption provided from AS 39.52120B3. That's the provision regarding use of state time, property, equipment, and facilities. But there is no exemption for B4, which is the taking or withholding of official action in order to affect a matter in which the public officer has a personal or financial interest. And in fact, most controversies involving the board would involve B3, not B4. So we think that an express vision regarding B4 is needed. And we have suggested language to that effect. It would say that participation in a matter before the board after disclosure is not considered to be a taking or withholding of official action in order to affect a matter in which the public officer has a personal or financial interest under B4 of this section. The second issue is the last sentence of Section 3 on lines 9 and 10 of page 2. It states AS 39.52.240 does not apply to matters related to this subsection. AS 39.52.240 is a section that allows the board to ask for advisory opinions. We think that cutting off the board's access to advisory opinions is very problematic. The Ethics Act will still be applicable. There are some specific exemptions, and they will be able to vote despite a personal or financial interest. But there are a number of other areas of the Ethics Act that will still be applicable, such as those dealing with improper gifts, 39.52130, improper use and disclosure of information, 39.52140, improper representation, 39.52160, declaration of potential violations, that's 39.52220, although there will be a partial exemption provided for that by this bill, and other sections of 39.52120, such as those dealing with seeking other employment or contracts, accepting or receiving or soliciting compensation for official duties, coercion of subordinates, and partisan political purposes. Those issues may still arise from time to time, and in fact, the provisions regarding gifts frequently arise with the board, and we think that it's important to preserve the board's ability to seek advisory opinions when issues arise, even concerning issues that they receive an exemption for under this bill. The board may still want an opinion from the Department of Law just to provide them with some assurance that what they're doing is right, and so that they can, when concerns are expressed to them, they can pass it off on the Department of Law rather than having to deal with constituents who are angry about their participation. So we would like to see that sentence deleted from the bill. Those would address all of the legal concerns that the Department of Law has with the bill, and we understand that the administration would not have any concerns with the bill after those issues were addressed.
Representative Wilson?
Steve, so you're saying on page 2 of the bill, delete the last sentence on line 9, are you talking about?
Yes.
And if we deleted AS 3952-240 does not apply to matters related to this subsection, that would take care of that?
That takes care of the second issue that we had. We still need to insert the other language regarding B4 as well.
We don't have the first one.
Yeah.
We have one.
Yeah. This is the first one, and the second one is just deleting that sentence.
I'm confused, I guess. You're here? We have one amendment.
Yes, both issues. This is Stephen Doherty from the Department of Law. Through the chair, the amendment deals with both issues. The first provision of the amendment is to delete AS 39.52240 does not apply to matters related to this subsection. The second part of the amendment is to add the provision regarding B4.
Okay, so it's not two amendments, it's one.
It's one amendment that addresses two issues.
Okay.
I move the amendment.
Okay. Representative Wilson moves the amendment. Hearing no objection, the amendment will be adopted. All right. It looks like we've got quite a bit of public testimony. We can at least start it right now. We'll go first to Petersburg. And the first person is Paul Shadura. I'd like to ask people to hold their testimony down to about 1 or 2 minutes, or we're not gonna get to everybody. We may not even get to everybody holding it to 1 or 2 minutes, but we can at least give it a try.
Sorry about that. I'm here.
So, Mr. Shadura.
Yes, thank you, Representative Ledoux and members of the House Special Committee on Fisheries. Actually, I'm in Kenai, not Ketchikan. Anyway, KPFA would like to thank Representative Wilson for introducing House Bill 241. We believe that this is crucial to allowing the Board of Fisheries to deliberate important issues without political interference. Current board policy requires that all adopted proposals must have 4 votes of the board in order to pass. No debate, argument, or information is allowed by an individual who are conflicted out. No system for defining conflict is in policy, except that the chair would rule on a conflicted issue for the individual if requested or contested. This is very awkward and allows for definition with subjective reasoning. Our experience with board members since statehood is that decisions by the board require as much personal knowledge by every board member that is available. It is expertise that prompts individuals to volunteer their services to the people of the state. Current interpretation of conflict seems to define commercial fishing as having more of a benefit to individual board members than commercial guiding. Yet definition in statutes that address this legislative conduct states that even non-monetary or benefits to an individual can also be implied as a conflict. This bill allows the affected users in the state a fair and equal voice to represent the issues openly, thoroughly, and fairly. We wonder what it would be like if doctors would not be allowed to advise on a physician's board or pharmacists or any other professional board. We would have non-professionals or those no longer involved promulgating rules for those that are. North Pacific Fisheries Regional Council is an example of a body that represents different segments of marine users, and it is understood that the individual board members represent a high degree of knowledge on specific issues and events. It is our ardent belief that a good board is one that takes into consideration all available information and discusses it from all aspects of the problem, and that this allows for more temperate and long-term decision-making, something the current Board of Fish does not incorporate at present. Please support this bill with a due pass out of this committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shadura, for your testimony. And Before we go any further, I'd like to recognize that Speaker Harris has joined us.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Next person from Kenai is Dr. Roland Maugh.
Yes, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Roland Maugh. I live at Kisilov, Alaska. I'm a commercial fisherman. I'm also the executive director for United Cook and Adrift Association. We would very much support House Bill 241, and that would include the amendments that have been put forward by the Department of Law. I think those are two very important amendments that need to be incorporated into this act. This is something that we've been looking forward to, having this statute changed to allow full participation that by members of the Board of Fisheries, no matter what their backgrounds be and what their interests are. That you know, that these fisheries are getting very complicated and I think require some of the best discussion and analysis and participation that we can bring to that as citizens, and removing any barriers to that would prevent that participation and that discussion, I think, is a positive thing in the life of Alaska. So anyway, we strongly support HB 241 with its amendments. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you very much. We'll go next to Petersburg, Carl Chrome.
Good morning. My name is Carl Chrome. Started fishing in 1960 when I was 20 years old. I'm going to be 65 this summer. From San Diego to Cape Denby in the Bering Sea. Participated in the tuna fisheries. I am a seiner, a gill netter, a troller, and a salmon. A gill netter and a herring, as also a seiner and a herring. Participate in all the longline fisheries and all the crab fisheries. Me and mine are very unhappy with our people getting conflicted out at the board meetings. It's already lopsided in the sport fish favor, and when our people are opted out or conflicted out, it makes us very unhappy. I don't have to remind you that we're the largest employer in the state, that we pay more taxes than any industry except the oil companies, and I suppose we have a lot more votes than any other, too. I don't know about that. You know that better than I would. Our people need to stay in there because somebody knows something is not a good reason to conflict them out. And we feel this is very unfair. I'm done.
Thank you. Next, Kodiak, LIO, Don Fox.
Is your amendment?
Good morning, Madam Chairman. Well, I support the bill, and I support the amendment by the Department of Law, and all my support is right on Representative Wilson's sponsor statement. I agree with everything she says. I'm a commercial fisherman. I'm a secretary of the advisory committee. I represent the advisory committee at the Board of Fish, and it's really frustrating. The governor appoints these people because they have this expertise in these areas, and they're not even allowed to deliberate our vote. And, you know, I think what applies to the legislature should apply to the Board of Fish. These people need to put their knowledge and expertise to use, and that's all I have to say.
My feeling exactly.
Thank you very much, Don. And finally, from, well, it doesn't say where from, maybe it's off site, I've got Steve Doherty and Art Nelson. But Steve, you've already, that's for questions, and I've got Art Nelson with a question mark. Art, did you want to testify?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name's Art Nelson. I'm chairman of the Board of Fisheries, and wanted to speak in favor of House Bill 241. I'd like to thank Representative Wilson for introducing the bill, and I was going to kind of hit on two general areas that the conflict of interest regulations have been problematic for the board. The first one is the difficulties that it presents oftentimes with the operation of the board and our functioning and our deliberations. As the chairman of the board, I'm kind of responsible to be the ethics supervisor for all the members. And so, of course, before each meeting, you know, I go around to the various members, particularly those that may have conflicts arising with the different meetings we have ahead of us, and of course, as you know, those conflicts can be, you know, either financial or personal in nature and can be interpreted very broadly. And I think Representative Wilson, in her introductory statements, mentioned also what is problematic is that oftentimes, even if there's going to be a perceived conflict, that we are advised to be conservative in that. And I again, it's no offense meant to the Department of Law. It's their job to be conservative and make our decisions be not only legally valid but defensible in court. And of course, as chairman, so do I. As many of you probably know, the board spends upwards of 40 or sometimes more days per year in our regulatory meeting, and the last thing I want to have happen is, you know, having an extensive regulation that took a lot of time to put together be struck down because we failed to follow the letter of the ethics rules. What's also problematic, and I believe Mr. Shadura mentioned it, with board operations is the potential for losing a board member due to a conflict of interest. We're a seven-member board, and regardless of how many board members are present and participating, so whether there's absences and or conflicts, we always still have to have four votes to carry any motion. And so, especially if it's compounded with an absence by another board member, a lot of times it becomes very difficult for us to take regulatory action. The other aspect that has been problematic over the years is getting a good pool of knowledgeable and experienced applicants for vacancies on the board. And, you know, I certainly don't want to slight any of the current board members or past board members, right? You know, we've got a great board and have had good boards in the past. But sometimes in previous years, as vacancies have arisen on the board, and I've kind of gone around and talked to folks who have participated in the process from the public side and tried to encourage them to put their names in for these vacancies, you know, their response back is, you know, why would I want to invest all of that time and effort if I, you know, can't even participate in the matters that I know the most about? And that's a good point. I think everybody kind of realizes that. So, again, I just wanted to support it. I haven't seen the amendments that Mr. Doherty spoke to, but from what it sounds like they are good amendments that need to be made. Of course, there are other aspects of the ethics rules that I don't think we want to see go away, such as the gift rules and other things. So it sounds like a good clarification there. So that's all I had. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any further public testimony on this? Mr. McCune.
Madam Chair, I'll be real quick. I know that.
Yield my time. Well, I have a letter in the packet.
Do you want to identify yourself for the
record? I'm Gary McCune. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska. I was trying to be real quick. And we have a letter in the packet. All 38 groups support this. We've supported it for the last 4 or 5 years. It's a problem when you have absent members or you have two conflicted out, or sometimes if you have a lodge owner that owns a lodge, it's $4 million. He's not conflicted out, but commercials, most definitely 99% of the time conflicted out. So I'll leave it at that, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Baker
chair,
Harris.
Through the chair, thank you. You know, I didn't realize this was the case, but, I mean, you know, most of the time, why would you want to be on the Board of Fisheries or on the Board of Game if you didn't have an interest in the subject matter being displayed in front of you? And obviously, if you're somebody representing commercial fishing, for instance, one group of commercial fishing, whatever it is, you're there. I mean, you're probably appointed to bring that point of view to the board. And if you're not allowed to vote on the dang thing when it comes up, what good are you? Other than you could voice your position, but if you can't carry it. It's like, you know, us in the legislature, you know, we're usually elected based upon our personality, right? Well, that's not why I got elected, but it's to bring your personal bent, whatever it may be, to the table here. And, you know, we're not able to vote on how we feel about something. Why would we be here? It would seem to me like the same reason that you'd have. That's why we have confirmations for board members of these committees, is because we want to see whether or not they're able to not only think about their particular interests, but are they broad enough if they represent, for instance, or they have a broad enough mind to look at some objectively sport fishing interests and other types of gears and that type of thing. You know, are they good enough person to, you know, do that? And so I don't see any reason why they should be conflicted out. They should be good enough people to say, and look at all aspects. So I said that.
Madam Chair, Representative Harris is right. I have been frustrated many times when a Board of Fish member is conflicted out and can't even speak or sit on the committee, so they just hang out in the coffee lounge, I guess.
I've been pretty impressed in that I've received quite a bit of written testimony from Kodiak, which isn't necessarily, as far as fisheries issues are concerned, one of the most united communities in the universe. And every letter that I've gotten has supported this bill. Representative Elkins?
Madam Chairman, I would move HB 241 as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying vote moves.
Hearing no objections, the bill is moved out of committee. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I ask for a reconsideration of House Bill 252, and I ask for that reconsideration to take place at this time.
Yeah. All right. I guess we'll call the roll on. Mr. Speaker, maybe you could guide me procedurally.
Motion is to bring it up under reconsideration or reconsider it. If there's objection, we should have a roll call vote to see whether it should happen or not.
All right. Please take the roll. Okay.
Yes.
Representative Harris.
Yes.
Representative Thomas.
Yes.
Representative Ledoux.
No.
Representative Elkins.
Yes.
Representative
Scannon?
No.
And Representative Capsner is absent.
Madam Chair, I move that we move HB
252
from committee with individual recommendations and a accompanying fiscal note.
Please call the roll.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Representative Harris?
Yes.
Representative Thomas?
Yes.
Representative
Ledoux? No.
Representative Scannon?
No.
All right. No further.
The vote was?
Pardon me?
The vote was?
4-2.
So the bill moves from committee?
Bill moves from committee. No further business on today's agenda. We will adjourn. The time is 10 o'clock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.